HD2, and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, July 5th, 2009, coming to you from Campbell Hall here at WIL AM 580. Our guest today is going to be a social critic, someone that we're pleased to have with us on the program. Has been here before, John Wilson, written numerous books, including on Barack Obama, political correctness, academic freedom, and a forthcoming book on Rush Limbaugh. It should be a terrific program, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy us today on Media Matters. First, though, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The House Commerce Committee held a hearing last week to investigate the impact of online behavioral advertising on consumer privacy. Companies like Microsoft and Google and advertising agencies routinely sift through consumers' online information to help target their advertising. Several members of Congress expressed their concern about these tactics. Representative Rick Boucher, a Democrat from Virginia, has been working with Republican Congressman Cliff Stearns of Florida on a bipartisan bill that would protect consumers. Most legislators agreed that consumers need to be better informed about who's using their personal information and how that information is being used. Republican Joe Barton of Texas.
I think it's a big deal if somebody tracks where you go and what you look at without your personal approval. We wouldn't like that in the non-internet world, and I personally don't like it in the internet world.
Jeff Chester testified at the hearing. Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy and has been working on online privacy issues for 15 years.
The online marketing industry has created this incredibly complex and far-reaching system designed to collect every little piece about us based on what we do online, the content we like and might not like, how much we put in our shopping carts, what we're willing to spend and not spend, you know, tracking us on a kind of 24/7 basis.
Chester says that the goal of this well-oiled commercial surveillance is to send us very powerful targeted messages based on neuroscience and brain research to bypass the conscious mind and work in our unconscious minds.
We will be asked to buy things as mundane as books, toasters, and clothes, but also to influence, and I think this is the key issue, influence our perceptions and our behaviors when it comes to financial and health matters and increasingly even politics.
Online commerce is here to stay, and it needs to thrive, says Chester. But it needs to be done in a way that gives consumers control over the information that is gathered. Public interest and consumer groups believe there should be no behavioral targeting without user consent.
The individual has to understand how that data is going to be collected, how it's going to be used. They need to be able to make decisions about how that profile is to be constructed, whether they want their ethnic information or financial information included in the profile. Look, the online marketers have created this ingenious, world-class digital data collection system. Surely they can also figure out a way to protect our privacy in the process.
And now for a Media Minutes Week in Media Roundup. On Tuesday, Julius Genachowski was sworn in as the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. The Senate voted unanimously to confirm Genachowski late last week. Media reform advocates and public interest organizations welcomed the new chairman as someone who will, as Seattle Times editor Ryan Blethen writes, put citizens before big media. Genachowski dove straight into a busy week, traveling to an event in Erie, Pennsylvania, where he talked about rural broadband access and the FCC's national broadband plan to connect everyone in the country to high-speed internet. He chaired his first official meeting with the commission on Thursday.
And in other news, the Personal Democracy Forum took place in New York City this week and brought together more than 1,000 participants. Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver was a featured speaker at the event.
The Personal Democracy Forum is a gathering of journalists, politicians, activists, technologists, and it really explores how the intersection of technology and politics are changing our media and political landscape. One of the striking events at the conference was a panel where I sat down with the leaders from AT&T and the Cable Association. We talked about Obama's broadband agenda and what's next in the internet. And it was striking to see how there's consensus amongst the people in the audience and people across the country that we must get fast, affordable, neutral internet into every home and business in this country. And that key to that is breaking open competition in the internet service provider market. The fact is cable and phone companies have been doing the very opposite for well over a decade, getting rid of the requirements that allowed competitors on phone lines to offer internet, getting rid of municipalities' rights to offer internet to their citizens. The end of the cable telco duopoly is near if we can move some of these policies that Free Press and our allies are trying to promote in the Congress and at the Federal Communications Commission.
You can find out more about the Personal Democracy Forum at personaldemocracy.com. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesson, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall, WILL AM 580, here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And we have a wonderful show for you today. Live on the phone lines with us is John K. Wilson, the author of five books, including Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest, which came out with Paradigm Publishers last year, Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies. And he first came on the map, to my knowledge, back in the mid-1990s, to date both of us and maybe some of our listeners as well, with the myth of political correctness. It is a pleasure to welcome John Wilson to the air. John?
Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, there's a lot. You're also working, if I understand, John Wilson, on a new book on Rush Limbaugh. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm finishing up right now. It should be out in the spring.
So we've got a lot to chew on today, and I think I'd like to start, if we can, with President Obama, Barack Obama. We didn't have an opportunity to have you on when your book, This Improbable Quest, about Barack Obama came out. So let's use this opportunity to talk a little bit about that book, your work on Obama, and sort of reflect on President Obama for the first 6 months or so of his administration. First of all, John Wilson, what is the nature of your relationship with Barack Obama? How did you get to know him? What is the nature of how you've understood him over the years?
Well, I first met him in the early 1990s when I took a class he taught at the University of Chicago Law School on racism in the law. And at the time, he was somebody who struck me as someone who's very thoughtful and knowledgeable and, of course, somebody I never imagined going to politics, actually. But he's, I think, surprised a lot of people throughout his career and what he's been able to accomplish. And so I knew him then. I knew him as my state senator when I lived in Hyde Park in Chicago for several years. And so we had a kind of distant relationship in the sense we knew each other, but there was no real close connection. I never actually interviewed him for the book. I was not part of the, you know, important media in any sense. And the book that I wrote, it was meant to be a kind of political analysis of Obama from a progressive perspective. And the way I sort of regard Obama then and now is, to use the term, as a pragmatic progressive. One of my books, I use that as a subtitle about pragmatic progressives. And I think that's what Obama really represents. And so my book was in some ways meant to defend him against some of the attacks from the left as well as the attacks from the right that were going on.
John Wilson, what sort of teacher was he?
Well, he was a very thoughtful teacher. He was not, you know, a kind of paper chase law professor who's out to embarrass people or attack people. He was not a professor who droned on, who loved to hear the sound of his own voice. He was someone who was genuinely interested in hearing what students had to say, and who was interested in challenging himself and his students and not creating a kind of groupthink. And I think, in many ways, I've used the phrase of him as a kind of professor president. And I think that's the hope that he's going to do something like that as well as president. He's not going to be someone just interested in having a bunch of yes men in the Oval Office. He is someone who's genuinely interested in hearing other voices. And that's one of the objections. It's also one of his flaws, of course, is that he's very open to hearing conservative points of view. He's sometimes far too willing to compromise, that he's someone who genuinely wants people to get along and agree upon something.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is John K. Wilson, the author of numerous books, including Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. And he writes about politics at the blog ObamaPolitics.com. So you can check out John Wilson's work there. He's also writing a new book on Rush Limbaugh, which we'll be talking about. And many of our listeners may be aware that John Wilson has been one of the foremost authorities on academic freedom and working to protect academic freedom in American universities for the past 15 years. So if you'd like to call in with a question or comment on any of these topics, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455 or our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. John Wilson, let's talk a little bit more about Barack Obama. I think that you've written a bit about the relationship of Obama with Bill Ayers, which became a big issue in the presidential campaign because Obama's opponents were basically trying to link the two together, both in the Democratic and Republican parties at different stages of the campaign. But, you know, I think there was a lot of people who were unclear exactly what the nature of the relationship was. There was a lot of heat, but not a lot of light. Were these guys friends? Does Barack Obama actually share some of the progressive political values of a Bill Ayers?
Well, he shares some of them, because I think Bill Ayers is in many ways not the radical he was pointed out to be. He used to be that radical, but today he's really part of the political and educational establishment in Chicago, and he was even throughout this controversy praised by Mayor Daley and various people. And Ayers has been involved a lot in school reform in Chicago, promoting small schools and fairly mainstream types of things. And so Obama had a relationship with him that was that really was professional. It wasn't so much of a friend's relationship between friends, even though Ayers and his wife Bernadine Dorn had hosted a fundraiser or a kind of a fundraising meeting for him, a meet and greet early in his state Senate campaign. But they weren't really friends of that kind that he was with other people. But certainly Obama was very friendly with him, and as he is with lots of people. So it wasn't anything unusual for him. He also had a relationship of being involved with as the director of a school reform foundation that was operating in Chicago for a number of years, where Bill Ayers was one of the main founders of that and was on the board of that. But again, it wasn't the case where Bill Ayers was really making these decisions or getting involved. And they both served on the board of a charitable foundation, but it was not the case that Obama was deciding to pick Bill Ayers or pushing for Bill Ayers. It was that the two of them were both interested in similar things, which was working with the progressive establishment in Chicago to try and help on school reform and juvenile justice and lots of other kinds of issues.
John Wilson, I'm just wondering, as I was reading a little bit on the website, some of the stuff you've been writing, do you think now, looking 6 months into President Obama's administration or 5.5 months into it, do you think there's a sharp difference between what sort of administration mood had Hillary Clinton been elected president in November on any key policies?
I'm not sure there would have been dramatic differences in terms of the key policies. I think a lot of the issues of the economic crisis have sort of driven a number of the decisions. And in some ways, I think Obama has been moved more to the mainstream by the desire to try and deal with that kind of crisis, particularly in the selections of Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, that he felt the need to try and stabilize the financial industry and in many ways to appease them. So in those respects, I don't think I don't think I've seen quite as many dramatic differences. I do think that Obama is a more effective manager in some ways than Hillary Clinton would have been, that he's someone who's very good at trying to manage a large operation, which the presidency is, and getting some fairly high-powered people like Hillary Clinton to do this kind of work with him. And so, you know, I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton would have been quite as successful, I think, as a manager that Obama has been. The policy differences, it's a little harder to say.
You know, a lot of people who consider themselves political progressives or on the left had some criticism of Obama when he was running for president against Hillary Clinton and then later against McCain. But I think it's not unfair to say that he probably had a majority of the progressive support of any of the candidates from the major parties, if not the overwhelming majority of support. Would you agree with that? I mean, I should start there. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, in the general election, certainly. In the primaries, though, it was very interesting to me how many progressives were aligned with John Edwards. And, mm-hmm. and I think they sort of bought into about who John Edwards was. I mean, of course, sex scandals that have followed have sort of shown that maybe John Edwards isn't who people thought he was. But I think many of them underestimated who Obama is because of the kind of rhetoric that he was doing, that he was using, that he was not someone using the rhetoric of the left, but he was someone who I think is one of the most progressive, probably the most progressive president we've ever had. And I think that that's not necessarily saying much, but I think it is saying something important.
What do you think, since he's been in office, if you had to point at the stuff he's done, you've considered most impressive from a progressive political point of view, what would it be?
Well, I think there's a number of things. One, I think, is simply getting the stimulus bill through very quickly at a very substantial amount. When there was a lot of political resistance that he had to overcome to some of that. Another thing I think that it actually has done that's been very impressive is pushing forward healthcare reform, which I think many other politicians would have waited to do, would have delayed doing, and I think he's been pushing that forward against, frankly, resistance within his own party among Democratic senators who are opposing, astonishingly, something as popular and obvious as the public option for healthcare reform. So I think there's a number of things. In some ways, it's very overwhelming to try and keep track of everything that's going on, precisely because it is a very ambitious agenda that I think Obama has put forward.
And on the other side of the coin, are there any particular issues in the first 5-6 months of the Obama administration where you've been disappointed that you think he has not been as progressive as he should have been? And let me also add to this, not simply in a sort of an abstract sense, but that he could have politically pulled off, not that you're asking him to do the impossible.
Well, I think he could have done more on the financial issues, and he could have appointed better people than, say, Tim Geithner. He could have gone with someone like Sheila Bair of the Federal Reserve, of somebody who could put a little more pressure on the financial industry and be less basically subservient to them. I think that's one of the mistakes, is sort of continuing the Bush administration policies on the bailout and doing it. There are very good reasons why he did that, but I think it is a mistake ultimately. You know, a lot of other areas, I don't think he's made really a lot of major mistakes. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen in the future, and you know, I think what he's done so far is a good start. The question is not what is he going to do in the first 6 months. It's much more what is he going to get done in the next year or so that I think is going to be much more of a test of how good of a president he's going to be regarded as.
Our guest today on Media Matters, John K. Wilson, who you've just been listening to, author of numerous books, including Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest, currently working on a new book on Rush Limbaugh, also one of the real experts on academic freedom in the United States today. He blogs at ObamaPolitics.com. John Wilson lives in Chicago. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for John Wilson here at Media Matters, the phone number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with John Wilson.
I just have a comment. I would like to say I think President Obama is doing a fantastic job with what he came into. I mean, the people that had this White House before, and the Republicans during all those years, and the people in the and on Wall Street, and the people at the top raped this country. They raped this country. They were greedy, and that wasn't enough. They had to get more greedy. They was not regulated, you know. I tell you, and then Rush Limbaugh. If you wanna know what evil is, he is evil. That man doesn't have anything good to say about Barack Obama. Fox on the television doesn't have anything to say good about him. There are such people. Those people are full of hate. And if the Republicans think that they gonna take over anytime soon, they better think again, no matter what, because everybody know when Barack took over and things, he inherited all of this. I mean, it is a mess, and I knew it was going to get worse.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Do you have anything more to say, or should we just ask John Wilson to comment on it?
Well, I would just like for him to comment on how do he think that he's working with the Senate and the Congress and things. Why is it that they will not work with Barack Obama, the Republicans? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And again, that's a great question. If I could add to that, John Wilson, when the Republicans were in power and the Democrats, you know, it seemed like the Republicans didn't even have a majority, but they were able to get a lot of their agenda through. And whenever they even had 51 votes, they got everything they wanted. How come when the Democrats have 60 votes, they still can't get stuff through?
Well, I think there are lots of answers to that. But one of the answers has to do with the issue of the conservative media and Rush Limbaugh, that for Democrats, there really isn't a progressive media that's deeply influential out there holding Democrats accountable, and a movement that makes them feel afraid to do these kind of shifts to the right that a lot of the Democrats in the Senate are really doing. But you have among the conservative media a deep influence on the Republican Party, where they've really been in some ways bullied by the fear of their base and the conservative media going against them, that they're very much afraid to go along with anything that Obama is doing, even though a number of the moderate Republicans, I'm sure, would love to do that. And you've had Arlen Specter actually having to change parties to become a Democrat, because he basically would have been destroyed within this hardcore partisan media. And that's even reflected in how in the past few months you've seen a number of cases where occasionally Republicans will go off message and say something critical about Rush Limbaugh, or criticize him for saying he wants Obama to fail. And whenever that happens, you almost immediately see this movement against them, and they're very quick, whether it's Michael Steele, the chair of the Republican National Committee, or other members of Congress who are Republicans, they're immediately going on and saying, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say anything bad about Rush Limbaugh. So that's the extent of the fear, I think, within the Republican Party of alienating this conservative media.
You know, the caller, John Wilson, the caller also was quite critical towards the Bush-Cheney administration, as have been many Democrats. One of the points of controversy in the Obama administration has been the reluctance of the Obama administration Justice Department or the White House to push for investigations and prosecutions of crimes committed by the Bush-Cheney administration. Do you think he's doing the right thing in taking this approach, or the Obama administration is doing the right thing by taking this approach?
You know, I think he does. Personally, I would love to see those kind of prosecutions and investigations, but I'm a very different person than Barack Obama. And Obama is someone who, in many ways, wants to get beyond the squabbles and partisan battles of the past and really does want to have a more bipartisan approach. And I think he sees it as something that isn't going to help in terms of solving problems. And I think he also realizes, and as well as David Axelrod and his advisors realizes, that that kind of trying to prosecute the past is not going to help him politically. That a lot of Americans are really much more interested in moving on, to coin a phrase, that they want to move on rather than deal with these kind of flaws in the past of the Bush administration. They want to fix the problems rather than punishing those who created them. And, you know, I think it's a reasonable political position that he's taking, and I think it has a lot to do also with his personality, that he is somebody who's not interested in getting revenge or recrimination.
John Wilson, not a trace of cynicism there at all in that answer, because generally oftentimes the concern is that people in power don't want to prosecute former people in power, so they won't be prosecuted themselves.
Well, I think there may be an element of that, but to be quite honest, the people in power now, you know, nobody in the Obama administration thinks they're ever going to do anything wrong that would ever get them prosecuted. And so I don't think that's so much of a big issue. I think there are some concerns about fears that setting precedents where any internal debates and discussions that go on within an administration can become public at any time. I think there's a certain desire, even within the Obama administration, to maintain that kind of culture of secrecy that really afflicted the Bush administration. I think that's a mistake, but I think it's something that's very common within the presidency.
Our guest today, John Wilson, author of numerous books, including Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest, working on a new book on Rush Limbaugh. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILLAM 580. The phone number here, because our show is live today, is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with John Wilson.
Hi, I'm kind of stumbling as to how to approach this. In all deference to Betty, the previous caller, I know in the African American community, it's hard to see the continuity that I see in the administration. Yeah, the war hasn't actually been the focus of discussion yet. The wars, the escalation. I'm not disappointed in Barack Obama because I didn't have the expectations that other people have. I didn't think he needed my vote in Illinois, so I didn't. It's just no one is suggesting that Barack Obama was around to was going to be perhaps dismantling the empire or something like that. But the fact that we have this continuity of policy in Iraq, the escalation in Afghanistan as we speak, is to not have that as a focal point of this of a discussion. I'm bringing it up, but I don't know how you're going to get around it because it is overwhelming. One salient that is just not being reported in the media on a show in the media is that there was supposed to have been a referendum confirming the status of forces agreement in Iraq. There was very little reporting on it. There was a New York Times article that said that the Obama administration was trying to get it delayed. They apparently successfully have delayed it 6 months. But the fact that it's not even discussed, and that the reason they were opposing it is because it probably would have suggested the status of forces agreement wasn't appropriate, that most Iraqis want the Americans out as soon as possible, is just boggles my mind. And I sound like I'm living on another planet, but I think it's mainly due to the fact that none of this is discussed. I think this betrayal of a referendum, a supposed democratic Iraq, will look in from future times very similar to the escalation in Vietnam that followed the U.S. refusal to let the referendum about reunification go ahead during the Eisenhower era. So I don't know how you're going to respond, but I'm glad I had my say. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And actually, that was next on my list, which was John Wilson, the connection between the Bush policy in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Obama policy. And I think the caller sort of elevated to a head, to a fine point, precisely what the concerns of many people are?
Well, first, I don't see Iraq headed towards, or this referendum headed towards the Vietnam quagmire. I think there's a danger of trying to think about wars using past wars as the basis, and I think it's a mistake for those on the left to sort of see Vietnam behind every war and to make that the standard, that if things aren't as bad as they were in Vietnam, then the war isn't a bad idea. I think that's a certain danger. Now, you know, obviously Obama is somebody who is not an anti-war candidate. He was someone who's critical of war in Iraq, who was someone who criticized it as a dumb war. And, you know, I think on the referendum, I think it does deserve more attention, but I think it's, again, part of Obama's policy, that he wants to get out of Iraq slowly and methodically, and that's what he's doing. And the danger of having the referendum, I think, that the Obama administration perceived, is that it might create a vote to get the Americans out immediately. And so I don't think that ultimately, you know, even though I'm a little disturbed by trying to stop a referendum, I think ultimately it's not going to affect what Obama was planning or the eventual removal of most troops from Iraq. Now, Afghanistan is another interesting situation where I think Obama bought into the myth of the surge, the idea in some ways that the surge is what brought peace to Iraq, that a surge in Afghanistan will solve the problems there. And I think there's a danger if he pursues that policy that it will not improve things. But I think what he's also been doing in Afghanistan is really changing the frankly quite incompetent management of that battlefield that was under the Bush administration with much more effective management of the war. And, you know, I don't think Afghanistan is going to be an easy conflict, but it's certainly not going to be a Vietnam. And I think in some ways it's going to be a question of whether Obama makes this surge a short-term effort or whether it becomes a long-term war as Iraq became. And I think that, again, it's going to be a matter of what the public does in terms of protests, in terms of raising opposition to war and calling for more troops to come a little earlier, because right now all of the political pressure is towards increasing our troops in Afghanistan and trying to win that war. So I think Obama is going to be led by public opinion. Right now, public opinion does not perceive the war in Afghanistan as going badly or as being a bad thing. And that I think, is what's ultimately going to affect him.
Do you think that's appropriate?
Yeah, I think in some ways public opinion, it should matter. I think Obama is going to pursue this. I think he really, as a campaigner for president, he pushed it as a way to sort of establish his bona fides as a tough guy, as a foreign policy person who was not going to, you know, by criticizing the Bush administration on Afghanistan and that, which, of course, reemphasized the fact that we should have been focusing on al-Qaeda and not Iraq. I think it was, in some ways, it's fulfilling a campaign promise, but also I think it's something where he thinks the U.S. has a chance to bring some sort of stability to that country. Now, that I think is going to be the question of how the war there gets managed. And so far, again, the left was in many ways divided on Afghanistan and the whole war in Afghanistan. That was, of course, a very popular war, unlike Iraq. And so I think it's going to be a question of what happens there and how effective the U.S. is in managing that war that's ultimately going to determine what Obama does next.
You know, most of the critics, I almost say most, some of the critics, to be fair, because I haven't surveyed all critics of Barack Obama's foreign policy, but some of the critics have argued that if you stand back and look at the Obama foreign policy in Iraq and Afghanistan and maybe around the world, you know, the farther you stand back, the less you can see that differentiates it from what McCain would have done or what Bush had done before, that it really from, unless you have to get really close and into the deep into the weeds to see very many distinctions. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I don't think that's really true. Now, it's true that in terms of the actions currently going on in Afghanistan or Iraq, it may not be a dramatic difference from what Bush was doing at the moment or McCain would have done. But I think the key thing for Obama is that he's not somebody who would start a war in Iraq. That's the key distinction. It's not that he's going to immediately end all of these wars and remove all troops instantly. It's that he's not going to get us involved in these future wars. I think that's a key distinction. The other important foreign policy distinction is that Obama is just such a superior diplomat compared to George W. Bush. The fact is he can pursue, in some ways, very similar kinds of policies, many of which are not terrible policies, but he can do it much more effectively because he's so much better at communicating with the rest of the world. And that is not, you know, diplomacy is very important, and it's not something to just dismiss because there's not a fundamental shift going on in foreign policy. The shift in diplomacy is, I think, a very important difference.
Our guest today on Media Matters, John Wilson, who you've just been listening to talk. He's the author of several books, including Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest, and a forthcoming book on Rush Limbaugh. The number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to call into the question or comment, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. John Wilson, it seems that we're sort of in a strange political situation in the United States today, because the Democratic Party has now won two consecutive elections in virtual landslide proportions, very close to landslide, if not actual landslide, depending upon how you define it, dominates politics in Washington, and by almost all indicators is the growing party of the future. Youth vote, demographics, any way you slice it, the Republican Party is heading in the wrong direction as a viable party. Yet because of our electoral laws, the Republican Party is one of the two games in town. How much does it affect the Obama administration that the opposition party is in the shape it's in?
Well, I think it's a big benefit to them. I think that they haven't been as aggressive as they ought to be in sort of pushing these differences and really utilizing this. And I think, again, it has to do with the sort of weakness among really the Democrats in the Senate of that there are a lot of them, many of them from conservative states who have a more conservative outlook. And so I think there's a reluctance to take a lot of chances and a fear that in 2010 what they don't want to do is they don't want to give what traditionally happens among Congress in off-presidential year elections is that the party in opposition gains. And I think they're really looking at things from a deeply political angle, that they want to make sure they continue doing well in 2010, and that's made them very reluctant to take any really big chances. And I think it's unfortunate because I think this is really an opportunity to push things forward more than they have.
You know, oftentimes in the last few months, Rush Limbaugh has been referred to as the titular head or the head of the Republican Party, the leading voice of the Republican Party. And as often as not, people, especially Republicans, will recoil and say, that's really ridiculous. He's a, you know, a millionaire radio show host who basically, you know, is not elected to anything. Where do you come down on the Rush Limbaugh head of the party issue?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that there isn't another alternative. I mean, and that's what's really, I think, what a lot of the Republicans are fearful about is that Rush Limbaugh is the de facto head because there isn't a political leader within the Republican Party that really drives a lot of energy within the Republican Party. And I think it is accurate to say he's the leader of the Republican Party because he is really, he pushes so many people, much more than any elected official does. And he pushes elected officials. And he's gotten much more active in doing these things. And the Obama administration, I think, very smartly sort of created this battle of Obama versus Limbaugh and really has tried to force Republican officials to put them in the position where they have to agree with this wacky radio show host who has extremely controversial and unpopular opinions, or they have to face the wrath of that host and his followers. And so I think the Democrats, the Obama administration in particular, has been very clever in sort of creating and elevating Limbaugh as the leader of the Republicans. And unfortunately, for the Republicans, they can't stand up and say, no, Limbaugh is just this idiot. They have to respect him, and they have for fear of losing their base.
Yeah, I know that I've seen the statistics for Fox News and the O'Reilly program, for example. The average age is very old of the viewer of the O'Reilly show. I don't know the exact year, but it's at least in the 60s, if not older. And I'm wondering, does Limbaugh have a younger audience, a more up-and-coming demographic, or is he?
No, he's very similar. He has a very old audience that he really doesn't have a lot of appeal to the younger generation, partly, I think, because of his far right-wing views, partly because of his shtick. He has this kind of, he was influenced by radio DJ Larry Lujack on WLS when he was young. And he has this kind of shtick he uses funny names for people and all these things that, are considered humorous to a very old generation, I guess, but don't appeal to kind of the Daily Show generation, which is looking for something a little more clever than parody songs, that is wants something more incisive. And so I think there really is the biggest danger for the Republican Party is not just the fact that they're unpopular now, but it's the fact that they're so unpopular among a younger generation that they're looking at a long-term minority status that will go on for decades. And that, I think, is the real threat they face.
Yeah, normally is not the correct word to use here, I should say. One might expect in the situation that the very existence of a political party would be in question, that this party might be on the way out altogether if it can't reform itself. Do you think that's possible, or do you think that the electoral laws are written in such a way that no matter how bad you get, you really are locked in, it's one of the two parties?
Well, no, I don't think the Republican Party is going to go out of existence anytime soon. And I think there will be a backlash, when they lose badly in 2012 and probably after that. I think you'll see a moderate backlash of the John McCain forces and that. There are people within the Republican Party who have not abandoned it, who strongly oppose the kind of conservative tilt that it's been taking from Rush Limbaugh and other leaders. And I think you'll see there is always a mechanism in politics that moves things to the center. The only question is whether this new mechanism of right-wing media is going to push things over and sort of delay that from happening for a long time.
You were saying earlier, John Wilson, that one of the things that the Democrats don't have, progressives don't have, is sort of putting heat on their politicians to respond to their base like the Republicans have with Limbaugh and the conservative media. Do you think it's possible in 2012 that there could be a third-party challenge to Obama from the left, from someone dissatisfied with a whole range of issues, not including foreign policy, banks, unions, environment, go right on down the list, civil liberties?
Well, there's always a challenge, though, with Cynthia McKinney from the Green Party. It won't go anywhere. The voting public has just become too sophisticated, especially after 2000 and Ralph Nader and the closeness of the election, that nobody is going to take a third party seriously because of the spoiler effect. And so I don't see any way that any alternative is going to be built into the current system.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest today, John K. Wilson, author of numerous books, including Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. Our next call, line 4, Chicago, you're on the air.
Thank you. Well, following through on what you just said about Ralph Nader, he recommended a book by Arnotto called The Grand Illusion, The Tyranny of the Two-Party System. I don't know if that's coming within your perspective to look into, but it's well worth it. Ralph recommended very highly relative to the possibility or impossibility of an independent or third party having any inroads or relevance, but we have other matters of the media being in such control that it's no wonder that anyone who wants to raise their head and speak up in a manner is not getting any recognition or surface to be heard. And so we have the control of the media and the Al Franken's election and other issues are being so tossed around and suppressed and keeping him from being opportunity to vote. And, of course, he wrote his book about Rush Limbaugh, Liar, Liar, something or other. So I just wanted to put out these comments for you to think about. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much, caller. John Wilson, anything to say to that?
Well, I think in terms of changing the political structure, it is very important. The real solution in terms of getting third parties is instant runoff voting, as having a way for third parties to exist without being the spoiler. And so that kind of structural change is what you would need to get. The problem, of course, is that I don't think the existing parties want to allow that to happen. So that's going to be that. And in terms of the media, of course, ultimately, I think that it has to be a matter of creating alternative progressive media and changing the way things are done and getting away and in some ways imitating what the conservative media has accomplished so successfully.
It's interesting, John, you say that because it seems like in your writing and your blogs, you're more interested in sort of articulating and defending Obama from the left and the right than criticizing Obama from the left. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate description.
So if we assume you do what you think is most necessary, you think that's the most necessary thing, at least for you to do. And, I mean, where exactly do the progressives – how do progressives get Obama to go toward his progressive roots? Is your model the best way you think to get that accomplished?
Well, I have to do what I think. You know, I'm not worried about that. I criticize Obama.
But I assume you want him to go more progressive, knowing your politics as I do, than he presently is.
Yes, but I also think that some of the criticisms are misguided. But I want to have misguided progressive criticism of Obama that's widely available. I want to have as many people on the left that I disagree with as there are on the right. That's what I think is important for our democracy. And, you know, I would love to have a situation where there's all these left-wing media people out here who I have to constantly criticize, where I think they're wrong. But the fact is that we don't have that anywhere in the mass media, and that's the problem.
Let's switch gears if we can, John Wilson, because we've only got about 10 minutes left. And one of the issues you've written about, I think, quite brilliantly over the last decade has been the state of academic freedom. And it only loosely relates to what we've been talking about so far, but still does relate. What's your general sense today of the state of academic freedom in American universities?
Well, it is slightly related. You mentioned Bill Ayers earlier, who is become one of the most, really the most commonly banned speaker on college campuses. This spring, there have been a number of campuses where he was banned from speaking either out of security concerns or fear of his views. So there's been a number of cases like that I think are very worrisome. There have also been some heartening cases in April of this year at the College of DuPage in the suburban Chicago area. There was a very conservative board of trustees that passed David Horowitz's Academic Bill of Rights, really in an effort to suppress political speech by professors on the left. And there was a movement, a really democratic movement by the unions who got new trustees elected that overturned this policy. And so it's in some ways very heartening that you can have union activism, you can have political activism that protects academic freedom. I think the real threat at the moment is sort of the broader movement to a more corporate university, and where you have academic standards being sacrificed for money and influence. And some of that you see even in the current scandal involving the University of Illinois admissions that the Chicago Tribune has been pursuing, where mm-hmm. people with in the Blagojevich administration, people with influence, were dictating the admission of unqualified individuals, and which is something actually that happens at almost every elite college, perhaps not to the extent as it has at the University of Illinois. But I think hopefully there's going to be a reaction to that that will say we need to have true academic standards at colleges. And hopefully it will go beyond just admissions to the, where we'll say that, you know, when it comes to research, when it comes to hiring and that we won't have a corporate mentality dictating where people with influence and money are guiding these things. We'll have a genuine academic idea of quality and standards that will guide the university. And that, I think, is really the movement that needs to occur to, in some ways, save universities from this corporate onslaught.
John Wilson, when you look at the array of academic freedom cases that you've seen over the past, say, 10 years or so, are there any particular issues that professors can raise that will get them into hot water faster than other issues? Are there real third rail or hot button issues that are more likely to raise the concern by their opponents?
Well, certainly Israel and Palestine is the biggest thing at the moment. And actually, I created a separate chapter in my Patriotic Correctness book just dealing with the controversies over professors speaking about Israel and Palestine because there was so much material dealing with it. And it was a decisive issue, for example, in Norman Finkelstein, who was denied tenure by DePaul University a year or two ago. That's been the core reason why there's been so much opposition to him, and it's been involved in so many other cases. So that is really the hottest of the hot button issues that are out there, and where I think open debate is really essential, and where there is a serious threat, I think, to our discourse that comes from this kind of efforts to suppress freedom.
Did you think Finkelstein got a raw deal from what you could tell studying the evidence?
There's no question about that. That what happened, in fact, is unlike many cases where the university really fires people without saying why, they were quite explicit. They basically said that he was fired because he did not display Vincentian values of basically being nice to people in his research, which is basically because he wrote books where he criticized harshly people like Alan Dershowitz. And people like Alan Dershowitz led a campaign to try and get him fired that astonishingly really succeeded. And it's a very alarming thing, whether it happens on the left or the right, of the idea that you have to follow a code of politeness in order to keep your job as a professor.
Are there professors on the political right, from your experience in the last decade, who have been facing abuse for not being politically correct on issues that are near and dear to the hearts of people on the left?
Oh, yes. That certainly, it even happened at DePaul. There was an adjunct professor at DePaul who was fired in similar ways because he got into an argument and insulted students at an activities fair and who was criticizing Palestinians. And so, you know, this does happen on the right. To conservatives as well, there is a kind of culture of not so much political correctness as it is a kind of consumerist culture where we want to avoid where university administrators want to avoid controversy, get rid of controversial faculty, avoid doing anything that might be controversial to students who are the consumers or parents or people who provide them with money, and so. This kind of corporate mentality that I think is growing in academia can affect both the left and the right, and we need to stop it, whether it's suppressing liberals or conservatives.
Our guest today on Media Matters, John Wilson, who you've just been listening to, author of numerous books. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. We've only got a few minutes left on the show, but we do have one more caller. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Chicago, welcome back to Media Matters.
I have a follow-up question to you. You were just talking about academic freedom. Well, regarding economic freedom, it seems that when President Bush was finally confirmed to be elected, the first person he saw was Alan Greenspan. Now, similarly, President Obama is entrenched seemingly with the economic wheelers and dealers. Rolling Stones has a brilliant article pointing out the tie-in with Goldman Sachs and other people of the hierarchy of the economic world that almost is an impelling factor in anyone's decision to do anything regarding the economy and so forth. So I'm offering that for everyone to try to look into and ask your opinion about the economic entanglement with the present group and so much. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And John Wilson, any comments on that?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. Obama, contrary to what the right wing would like to believe, is not a socialist, not in any way, shape, or form, and except in, of course, the kind of corporate welfare socialism that reigns supreme and has for many years. You know, and I think that has to do, it has something to do with his personality. I think it has to do with the political structure he finds himself in, that he only could raise the money to become a serious, viable presidential candidate by being a kind of centrist defender of the capitalist system as we know it. That's the only way he could become president. And until you change that financing system, it's not going to, you're not going to get candidates who do that. I think I wish Obama was more courageous and willing to fight that kind of financial establishment in the U.S. because in many ways he's created an alternative way of financing campaigns through the Internet, through this massive organization that he created. But, you know, it's something where in order to get his foot in the door, in order to be taken seriously and really create that kind of movement, he first had to be kind of acceptable to the political and financial establishment in America. And he proved that he was, and he's not going to fundamentally change who he is at this point.
John, we've only got a couple minutes left here on the program before we have to go. What's your sense of how the mainstream, not the right-wing media, not Fox and Limbaugh and that crowd, but, you know, the mainstream news media, how have they done in covering the Obama administration so far?
Well, I think they've done badly, like they always do. I think during the election, frankly, there was a moderate bias against Obama, contrary to a lot of people see in the mainstream press, that they were more willing to criticism on things like Bill Ayers than they were about, say, John McCain's links to G. Gordon Liddy or Oliver North. But what you've seen since the election is the media falling into step as they do about every president. They really are very submissive to whoever is in power. And in many ways, I wish that we had a more aggressive media that was willing to challenge what Obama was doing, especially from the left.
And, you know, we've only got a few seconds left. If you could point our listeners to media that do a good job at covering the Obama administration and national politics, where would you point them to?
Well, I think there are lots of good magazines like In These Times, The Nation, and some others that do that. There are websites like Daily Kos and some others where you can find some of these kinds of things. Democracy Now, I think, is one of the best sources for this kind of information, as well as places, you know, alternative media in terms of books, of documentaries. There are a lot of great materials out there. The problem is that they don't really enter into the mainstream. And that's what I think progressives need to build, is a more mainstream media for expressing these views.
John Wilson, when is the Limbaugh book coming out?
It should be out in the spring.
And what's the title going to be?
The title is Rush Limbaugh is Still a Big Racist Idiot.
So, I guess we get a sense of where that one's coming from. John Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Thank you.
Hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to get Tavis Smiley in the studio. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for doing a great job as usual. Kyle Kroha for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney again, and I will be back in 167 hours. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today we'll see increasing clouds and warmer temperatures with a high around 80. Tonight, mostly clear skies with a low of 59. Monday, mostly sunny with a high of 82. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low around 60. And Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high of 85. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.